Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
Much movie correspondence in already, a lot of it on the subject of The Brothers Grimm, which we'll get to fairly shortly. Movies coming up will include Elizabeth Town Murder Ball, The Beat That My Heart Skipped, as well as The Brothers Grimm. Box office top 10 this week. Pride and Prejudice, this week's number 10.
It's okay, it's fine. It's certainly from Kira's point of view, it's a lot better than Domino.
Lord of War at 9.
A very good idea, a very good performance by Nicolas Cage. Sadly, however, doesn't work as a film and doesn't work as entertainment, which is a shame.
Number 8, Into the Blue.
Ho-hum-her. Just, nah.
Ho-hum-her and nerd. Under what sort of definition of movie criticism does justify its existence?
Because it is just like you go, yeah, fine, okay, on to the next one. It's 90 minutes long.
What is it, a cartoon or a musical?
No, it's a live-action piece of whimsy that exists for no reason other than to show off its stars. Let's move on.
Broken Flowers at 7.
See, fantastic. Loads to say. Bill Murray, great. Yes, he may be doing the same thing, you know, over again, but who cares, because he does it so well. Jim Jarmusch has managed to remain independent in the best sense of the word. It's a film which is melancholic and funny and, you know, moving and profound and yet also whimsy.
All right, that's enough. Six,
exactly.
Sky High.
You see, you asked. Sky High is actually a lot better than you'd think it is. Sky High is a kind of live-action version of The Incredibles. Of course, it's not anything. It's not The Incredibles, but it's much funnier than the appalling premise sounded like.
Timothy Burton's Corpse Bride at 5.
Loved it. My 4-year-old loved it. My 6-year-old loved it. One of my 6-year-old's friends didn't like it, so it is true, apparently, that if your kids aren't absolutely, you know, happy in the cinema and are sometimes creeped at, then they may find it a bit edgy. But hey, honestly, it's great. It's really, really great.
Alice Cooper's kind of movie at 4, The Legend of Zorro. He said he was a big fan.
Yeah, I wasn't. I mean, I didn't like the original is obviously a remake. I didn't like the first one of these, and I didn't like the second one anymore. And it's kind of like, yeah, fine, okay, it'll take a bunch of money. And that's not a massive amount of money going in at number 4, is it?
Number 3 is Saw 2.
Haven't seen it. They only previewed it the week that I was away, so I'm going to try and catch it over the weekend. So please don't tell me anything about it, anyone who's seen it already, because
that would be great.
It would be great, wouldn't it? Yeah, actually, now you can get your own back. Somebody can email me in the end and spoil it for me for once.
Apparently there's not a lot of amputational fun.
Isn't there?
No, not this time.
I'm off it already then.
Nanny McPhee at 2.
I'm amazed that it's got a U certificate, just because there is a lot of scrungy humour in it, which starts with they've eaten the baby. And, you know, it's grotesque. They haven't, but it's a gag, but you think they have. And it's got great grotesquery, and the purple colours are absolutely puce, and I do like Colin Firth. And it's not Mary Poppins, but it wants to be scary Mary Poppins, and it's quite enjoyable.
The UK's number one, still, Wallace and Gromit, The Curse of the Were-Rabbit.
You know, what's to say that hasn't already been said? It is the Citizen Kane of animations, and it's just terrific. And I need to go and see it again, because I know that there were jokes like the nun wrestling gags and all the rest of it that just, they fly past so much the first time that you must have missed a whole lot of it. It's absolutely wonderful.
You can go see something in the top 10 or one of these, which is new.
Well, should we do The Brothers Grimm? Because it's, you know, it is kind of big movie of the week. And it's a new Terry Gilliam movie. And I can't believe that I'm talking about a new Terry Gilliam movie with a heavy heart. I mean, it seems like such an unlikely thing. As you know, I've been a huge fan of Gilliam's all the way through his career. I thought that Brazil was one of the 10 best movies, you know, certainly one of the 10 best British movies, but one of the 10 best movies, I think. I absolutely loved it. I liked The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. I thought 12 Monkeys was a wonderful piece of work. And he's one of our great visionary directors who always has fights with his producers, but usually triumphs. In fact, had always triumphed up until the case of The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, which famously never came to fruition and ended up being a documentary called Lost in La Mancha, about the project literally falling down around his ears, although he still hopes that he will get it up and running again. When The Man Who Killed Don Quixote fell apart, the story is that Johnny Depp and Terry Gilliam made a pact with each other. They both go off and make a mainstream movie, and then they come back and get Don Quixote off the ground again. Depp obviously went off and did Pirates of the Caribbean, for which I've never forgiven him.
Great
despite
film.
The fact I think he's a great actor, and I think he has great things in him still. I watched Ed Wood again the other day, and he is so good in Ed Wood. Terry Gilliam managed to get himself, I think, saddled with The Brothers Grimm, which is based on a script by Aaron Kruger, who's a bit of a hack, who did the Americanized version of The Ring. And he's a perfectly adequate hack, but he is a hack. And the story is that The Brothers Grimm are real brothers, as indeed they really were. But at the beginning of the movie, rather than being sort of bookish intellectuals, they are con merchants who go around the country finding out about people's folklorish fears, then making spoof versions of those fears, which they then exorcise for money. So they're basically scam artists. And they are then required to go and visit a village from whence children are being stolen. And the village sits on the edge of this huge great wood, and when they go into the wood, they discover that actually all the fairy tales that have been haunting them are real and true. There really is a huge tower with an ice princess in it who's been asleep for 500 years. There really are wolves which transform into men. There really are Little Red Riding Hood characters running around. So it's basically the nightmare becomes reality. Now, you would think that this is perfect Gilliam territory. With the three main characters, Matt Damon, Heath Ledger, doing English accents, and Lena Headey, about whom more in a moment.
Given that this is Napoleonic-occupied Germany, why do they speak in this English way?
Well, Gilliam himself answered that question, didn't he? He said, because, you know, having them speaking in cold German, which, of course, you know, would be funny, nevertheless, the gag would wear thin. So, basically, he gave them what he considered to be flat accents, and flat accents comes out as English accents. And actually, it's not a problem. They do talk in no fixed accents, and there is a sort of accentual problem during the movie, which is that you do wonder at some point exactly what accents they're doing. But I have to say, it's the least of the film's problems. Now, every single Gilliam movie comes with you with a backstory of the fights that he's had with his producers, and he was on the show before and he talked about this. In this particular case, I think he lost the battles with the producers. One key thing, his leading lady was going to be Samantha Morton. He was overruled on that. He wasn't allowed to cast Samantha Morton for reasons which fail me, frankly. And instead, the central role went to Lena Headey, who, although I think is a perfectly fine actress, I think was lost in that role. Also, his chosen DP, Nicola Paganini, was fired.
Director of photography, is it?
Yeah, director of photography, cinematographer. Was fired by the... Or not fired, was not allowed to continue working on the project by the wine scenes and was replaced. So, Gilliam was working under very difficult circumstances with very, very hands-on producers, with a cast which wasn't his ideal cast, with a cinematographer who wasn't his first-choice cinematographer. Now, I think that the result is a severely compromised Terry Gilliam film, to the point that I think it is the least Gilliam-esque film of his I have ever seen. He, however, was on the show a couple of days ago.
Yes, we put some of these points to him. Here's Terry Gilliam on this programme a couple of days ago.
Also about my films I've discovered over the years is they seem to have awfully long legs. And I love DVDs for this because now people, they may see it in the cinema, but the second viewing and the third viewing becomes better and better. And I think it was one of the things, I was in Japan and this young actress had seen the film and we were doing a press conference together. And she was, you know, raving about the film. But she said, the thing is, I saw it a second time and it's even better the second time. And I want Mark to go and watch the film a second time.
Okay, so this is in response to the fact that I had reviewed it in Sight and Sound, and I had said, much as it really depresses me to say so, it's not a Gilliam film. It's not a proper Gilliam film. Basically what it is it's a kind of great big mainstream fairy tale movie that has elements in it in which you can see Gilliam doing what he does brilliantly. And I say this with the greatest respect to Gilliam because I really think he is one of cinema's true geniuses. But actually, the film itself is incoherent. It's got script problems that have never been resolved despite or perhaps because of several rewrites. The script itself is rather limp. The central female performance just doesn't cut the mustard in a way that it really, really needs to emotionally involve us. The end of the film is incoherent to the point that having seen it once, and, you know, Terry says, I should go and see it again because I would, you know, and I will go and see it again because it actually breaks my heart to tell you how much I didn't like it. Literally made no sense. It's a whole bunch of stuff happened and then the film ended. And I'm not alone in this because I've asked other people who've seen the film to just explain to me in terms of the plot synopsis, which I had to write in Sending for Sight and Sound, exactly what happens. And you'd be amazed to see how people wrestle with it. Now, this is extraordinary. People have said in the past, Terry Gilliam's movies are explosions and they're unruly and they romp all over the place and they're all visual, but there's nothing underneath. This is rubbish. This is the most unfair criticism leveled at Gilliam's movies. Gilliam's movies are fantastically coherent. They do have real stories with real people and real emotions and real points of entry to them. And people who say they don't are just nitwits who don't understand that it is possible for somebody to be a great visual director and also somebody who understands actors and understands personal relationships. And I think that Gilliam has always done that. And I completely despise this sort of, oh, he's a visual stylist and nothing else. No, he isn't. Nor, incidentally, is he somebody who's, you know, out of control and flagrant disregard for money and all those things. If you look at Lost in La Mancha, you realise that he's a man who is worrying about every single element of production. That actually, if you allow Gilliam to make the movie he wants to make, he makes something that has a human heart, but also has an extraordinary visual sense. And in the case of this, it's not there. And my rationale for this is that in the end, it's not a Gilliam, it's not un film de Terry Gilliam. It is a film that Terry Gilliam has directed whilst fighting a battle with people who want to make a mainstream Hollywood movie. Now, on several levels, it's failed. It's not the huge hit that it ought to have been in order to justify these compromises. I mean, certainly in America, it's done all right, but it hasn't done anything like the business that it should have done. Terry said, when you were interviewing him as well, he said that my review of it sort of smacked of somebody just parroting what the Americans had said. Which, he has every right to defend his film, and it's good that he should do, because all films are like children to their directors. The fact of the matter is, it's nothing to do with what the Americans thought. It's to do with a disappointment from me, a fan, who wants to see a Terry Gilliam film, who wants to see a film that has that Gilliam-esque sense of magic, and ended up watching, to me, a Weinstein Brothers movie with flashes of Gilliam in it. And I think the greatest criticism of it to me is it has less to say about Little Red Riding Hood than M. Night Shyamalan's The Village, or, we were talking about Neil Jordan's Company of Wolves recently, or even, oddly enough, The Guardian, which is a total mess in terms of, it's a film that's all over the place, but actually there are moments in which The Brothers Grimm reminded me of The Guardian, which I think, even as a Friedkin fan, I think is a mess of a film. So I was disappointed. I was heartbroken. I love Gilliam. I think that the fault of the film is not his. I think it's fantastically honourable of him to say, no, it's all my film, and if you don't like it, it's my fault, but I just don't buy it.
I think it was the longest answer I've ever had.
Well, it's because
here's Rob.
It's because I do feel, as you can tell, I feel genuinely troubled by this.
It's all right. You don't have to say it again. Rob Haler here on says, last night I went to see The Brothers Grimm as part of the Leeds Film Festival, thought it was a mess. The funniest thing was the credits at the end. Matt Damon had a voice coach, a movement coach, and a dresser. I was reminded of his puppet in Team America World Police.
Matt Damon!
As it was as... What?
That's the puppet in World Police. Right. I mean, that's the only thing he can say.
As it was a special presentation, Terry Gilliam was there in person and was due to be interviewed by Kim Newman at the end of the film. Unfortunately, Kim Newman couldn't make it. I reckon this was because he'd been injured in a handbag fight he'd had with Kermode to decide which of the two was the UK's preeminent genre cinema critic.
Can I just say it's Kim?
For what it's worth, I reckon Newman might win on writing style, but Kermode has him on hairstyle. If there was no feud between them, can we invent one? Interesting email from Peter Smith, who's our friend in Prague.
Hi Peter. How's Prague?
You may well remember.
Because they shot a lot of it out there.
Exactly the point. He says, Simon and Mark, as you're reviewing Brothers Grimm this week, word has it here in Prague, where it was made, that all the crew thought that Terry Gilliam was barking mad, especially when he wanted to torch the lovingly constructed village set. I wanted to write in about this when Gilliam was on the show, but was too scared.
Can I just say, for the record...
No.
Okay.
Well, what, is it brief?
Yeah, it is brief. For the record, Gilliam's films may depict a mad world, but he is incredibly sane.
That
he is a very, very safe pair of hands.
More to come, mayo at bbc.co.uk, 85058. Five Live, some correspondence here, as it kind of gets in the way of the reviews, but we'll get to Elizabeth Town, which I think is next. This is Jeff, Jeff Marchant in Norfolk, on the subject of Brothers Grimm. Saw this a couple of months ago. Actually, Mark is absolutely right. While it looks cleverly made, but what film doesn't these days? Brazil or 12 Monkeys, it certainly ain't. Okay. No edginess whatsoever. Stephen Stroud, with high hopes, I took my 9-year-old daughter to see Wallace and Gromit, and we both nodded off.
Oh, no!
As you suggested, it was an hour too long. I don't think you said
that. No, I didn't say that.
Great lighting and so on, but nothing else. The storyline is extremely boring, with no dark character to match the sense suggested by the dark streets. Everyone was in fits with the Penguin cartoon before the main film Wallace and Gromit started, and it was silent. That says it all. I think he's just wrong.
Yeah, I think just... Went to see a different film.
Peter Jones, went to see Broken Flowers this week. Absolutely fantastic. Great. Bill Murray is the best actor working in Hollywood at the moment. Film of the year.
It's lovely. It's
Simon
really lovely.
In Froome, could you ask Mark what happened at the end of Broken Flowers? It was a bit too arty and I didn't get it. Maybe you should.
I can't, no, because, you know.
It's too arty and maybe you didn't get
because it's one of those things that, you know, then I'll get letters saying, how dare you give away the end of the film.
Colin
know?
In High Wycombe, please tell Mark that it's either whence or from where, not from whence, which means from where. Because whence means from where.
I stand corrected.
Indeed. Pedant's Corner, open at
no,
all
but thank
times.
You for that. That was good. Did I say from whence?
But from whence, which
send
is from
where.
Send
them back from whence they came. So it should
can't
be send
that.
Them back whence they came.
Yes.
Fine.
Or from where.
No, good. And it's like you can't have a myriad of. That's the other one that really annoys me.
Paul in Leicester. It's not always I agree with Mr. Kerman. However, after watching A History of Violence this week, his much-derided Viggo Mortensen-De Niro comparison may not be as wide of the mark as I thought.
Thank you. Begins here.
Mortensen brings real emotional depth to the role in the final scene, which I won't mention there, nearly brought me to tears. Monica Bello also deserves a mention for a superb performance. Right, so we've only done Brothers Grimm, so what else is new?
Elizabethtown.
I thought you'd forgotten that.
Maria Bello. Elizabethtown. New movie by Cameron Crowe. Now, I like... See, I've liked Cameron Crowe a lot in the past.
Don't take it personally again.
No, I'm not going to take it personally. Everything that I've said is wrong with Brothers Grimm is but naught in comparison with Elizabethtown. Now, Cameron Crowe, you know, script for Fast Times at Ridgemont High, great, say anything, good. You know, Jerry Maguire, liked it, fine. Even You Had Me at Hello, got away with that. Really liked Almost Famous. And he's a really nice guy and a really good writer and he understands rock music.
But, okay.
Elizabethtown is described in its press notes as a uniquely crafted comedy set in the key of life, a life-affirming comic fable that takes on matters of life and death in a surprisingly heartfelt way. And it's a film which asks the question of how do you say goodbye to someone you've hardly said hello to? Now, if you're not already on the floor throwing your guts up, let me tell you about the story of Elizabethtown. It stars Orlando Bloom, the huge acting talent that is Mr. Orlando Bloom, the Donny Osmond of his generation, only without the teeth, or indeed the talent, the pretty boy who we cast because loads and loads of young girls find him fabulously unthreatening and want to take him home to mother him, and all the studios want to get their hands on those person's pocket money. So Orlando has a crisis. Everything's really bad. Terrible things happen at work. He has to get on an airplane to go home because his father's died. He doesn't really know his father, but his father's died. On the plane, he meets Kirsten Dunst, who's a perky air stewardess.
She's going out with Spider-Man, though.
She may be, but there's a different film now,
isn't
it?
She's spoken for.
In the real world of movies?
No, just last film I saw.
Well, honestly, it doesn't matter because she's got so much life-affirming good. She's the film's messenger of love, according to the notes.
She's going out with Paul Bettany, isn't she?
Is she?
Oh, no, in the movies.
In the movies, yeah. Well, in this particular movie, she's just going out with life and love and the spirit of joie de vivre.
You get bored with that.
And she decides, you know, in that way that air hostesses often do, to befriend this way-faced little twit on the plane and make sure that, in fact, he goes on a journey, a spiritual journey, a journey in which he'll discover all the things about himself that have been thrown aside as he goes to oversee the memorial service for the father that he never really knew.
Why have you gone all camp again?
Because it's really hard to talk about Elizabethtown.
You're mincing your way through this.
I'm trying not to swear, actually. And she draws him a map of how to discover not only where the place is, but where the place in his heart is. She's so quirky and perky and absolutely full of sparkle and vim and vigour. And he discovers that although he didn't really know his family, his mother is suffering very badly. And she's played by Susan Sarandon. There is a moment in the film which Susan Sarandon demonstrates how her life-affirming joie de vivre has overcome the tragedy of the film by tap dancing at her dearly beloved's memorial service, at which point it was all I could do to stop from standing up and shouting, "Stewardess! The bath bag, please!" You expect oxygen masks to drop down from the ceiling and people to be carried out on stretchers following the red lights, taking them to the nearest exit. Because there's a thing in Problem Child 2 when there's a bunch of kids on a carousel, right? And one of them starts being sick. And because one of them starts being sick, the one behind starts being sick. And suddenly there's this sea of spew that literally splatters around and people are swimming in. It was like that. I was swimming up the aisle of vom as the sugary confection of life-affirming schmaltz and general bonhomie. And actually, you know, if we were all just a little bit more quirky, a little bit more whimsical, everything would be right. It was like, shut up, Cameron. You can't do this. It's horrible. He can't act. She's really annoying. And you are letting the side down. And pains me because I like Cameron Crowe.
You've been in enough pain this week.
I have. Believe me, the pain of Elizabethtown was just... And it's gone straight in there. It's up there with Revolver and Gus Van Sant's Last Days as, you know, how much does it stink more than a very stinky thing indeed?
Arthur on this, Elizabethtown, what a pile of tosh. You know who I blame for Orlando Bloom? Peter Jackson, that's who.
Well, and, yes.
And he's going to wreck King Kong. Says Arthur. Mayo at bbc.co.uk. Number of people making this point to Mark. This is Pete from Basildon in Essex with reference to the 100 Greatest Scary Moments, which is on TV recently. Loads of contributions.
Well, hang on, there must have been a repeat because it first went about 3 years ago. Well,
presumably it is then. Couldn't understand the choice of Jack Nicholson's Here's Johnny moment at number one. It always made me laugh rather than jump.
No, it's nonsense.
Only person apparently who wasn't asked their opinion on The Exorcist was you, which is probably a very wise thing to do.
Right? Yeah, I'm assuming that this is a repeat of the 100 Scariest Moments thing they did. It was at least a couple of years ago that it went out, so they must have repeated it. Yeah, and it's silly because the Jack Nicholson thing isn't the... I think I did talk to them about The Exorcist, but I can't remember.
Maybe they didn't include it on the basis that we all know what you think.
Yeah, exactly. It seems unlikely that I wouldn't, but I can't remember, to be honest.
My friend Gail says Martin Jackson in Cramlington, who happens to be a film lecturer at Tyneside Cinema and is a big Gilliam fan, also thinks that Brothers Grimm is a mess, which is a pity.
Yeah.
On the subject of pedantry, Shakespeare often said, this is according to Harry in Durham, Shakespeare often said, from whence? So Mark's in good company.
Oh, that's good.
And
me and the bard together at
Crazy
last.
Horse says, whence means now, so that you can use the phrase from whence, but not from whence you came.
But, I'm sorry, have I just hallucinated, you know?
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Peter, you can...
That's just like saying the word tomato means apple.
You can, if you like, relive all these precious radio moments. You can download them from the website and carry them around in your iPod all week. And apparently, in a global list, which was discussed today, in a global list, the podcast of your movie reviews on this programme is number two.
Really?
Which is, I don't know, a couple of people must like it.
What's number one? Who do I have to deal with?
Peter Smith in Prague is back. He's clearly got nothing else to do. You're right, Mark. Orlando is rubbish. But surely when they inevitably remake Jason and the Argonauts, he's a shoo-in for the lead role. We ought to do any more movie releases before we get more correspondence.
So there is a good thing this week, which is The Beat That My Heart Skipped, which is a French language remake, kind of remake, of James Toback's film Fingers, which is a great Harvey Keitel film, which people I imagine will be familiar with anyway. Apparently what happened was the guy who produced the remake of Assault on Precinct 13 had said to the director, Jacques Audiard, do you want to remake something? He said, yes, I want to do Fingers. And so what we have now is this really pretty terrific film with a great central performance by Romain Duris. I think you do pronounce the S. I did ask a couple of people, and some people thought you did, and some people thought you didn't. I maybe get pronouncing his name wrongly, but he's a fantastic actor. And he plays a guy who is on the one hand, his father is a horrible real estate owner, a developer who uses him as a kind of muscle man. On the other hand, he has this devotion to the piano, which he had as a child. His mother was a pianist. This is all gone completely by the by, but a chance meeting with the man who once represented his mother encourages him to get back into his piano playing. And exactly as with the James Toback film Fingers, it's about the tension between light and dark, between something which offers a possible salvation and something, on the other hand, which he's very, very good at. And it's really well judged. It's really, really well played, beautifully put together in a way which, on the one hand, pays homage to the James Toback original. I have to say that although I like Fingers, I'm not generally a huge Toback fan. I think he's guilty of terrible indulgence in his later films. And I think that The Beat That My Heart Skipped is formally very tight, very precise, very moving, very engaging, often very sort of charming and funny, but also quite scary, because what you have in this central character is this hero who's divided between his two selves. And when he's playing the piano, all the rage, all the violence, all the, you know, the other half of his life is still there as he's trying to, you know, get all this stuff out on the piano keyboard. Meanwhile, whilst he's doing all the thuggish enforcing, we are aware that there is something else going on in his head. And it's a really terrific movie. On paper, it sounds like a very strange thing to do, to make a French language remake of that particular film, which is such an American film and which owes such a debt to, you know, to Mean Streets and to Scorsese and to Coppola, and is described here by the director as the dog end of that great 70s wave. And I think, you know, it is that to some extent, but this in its own right, it's a terrific piece of work. And I have not yet spoken to anyone who didn't like The Beat That My Heart Skipped. It was really weird because when we were all seeing it in the national press shows, we'd all gone through everything else and we came out of The Beat That My Heart Skipped, possibly because things had been so bad elsewhere in the week, but everyone was going, was it me or was that really great?
Sounds like a translated title.
No, it's not, because the original title is Fingers. And as you know, that the translation of Fingers would have been...
Phalange. Sounds like.
Oh, that was probably Il Phalange. That's Italian. I'm not even going to try.
Martin,
hear the emails coming already.
Martin in Old Portsmouth, one of the old regulars. Dear Waldorf and Statler, so, Terry Gilliam, Tim Burton, one, are both now, in the eyes of Mark, worthy of auteur status?
Oh, yeah, they always have been.
Two, which of the two probably eats the most cheese before they go to bed?
You mean in the ways that cheese makes you dream?
I imagine so.
I think an equal proportion of Edam.
And Wallace and Gromit. Can we now put Gromit up with Chaplin, Keaton and Lloyd as one of the truly great silent movie stars? I thought the film was a work of genius.
I think you can. And actually, of course, Nick Park himself has referred to exactly those silent movie stars in terms of the inspiration for Gromit's movements and facial expressions. I mean, they are clearly the work of somebody who understands great silent movie comedy.
That's a great way of looking at it, isn't it?
It is.
Chaplin, Keaton, Lloyd, Gromit.
Yes, brilliant.
Put
perfect.
Them all up there. What else?
Murderball. Now, this was a real unexpected treat for me. Murderball is a documentary about a sport which in its initial phase was referred to as Murderball, although as one of its key players points out, it didn't turn out to be a very marketable title, so they had to retitle it, and it's now referred to as either quad rugby or wheelchair rugby. It's played by people with quadriplegia in these wheelchairs, which have basically been redesigned to look like something out of Mad Max.
I've seen them play at the Paralympics.
Yeah, and it's just... I
think Murderball's a great name.
Because Murderball actually pretty much sums up what it's like out there on the court. It is a sport played by, you know, guys who are really intense and really fantastically fit and really have one goal, which is to win. And, for a start, clearly it's the best sports movie of the year by some distance. I mean, it is really, really riveting stuff. One of the brilliant things about the way that the film is constructed, however, is it has at the centre of it this extraordinary rivalry between the Americans and the Canadians. And what happens before the film starts is that one of the guys who was a key American player was cross about not being chosen for the American team, and then he deserted and went to become the Canadian coach. And so the Canadians and the Americans have this great big grudge match going on, with the Canadians being coached by the guy who was the American star and then went over. And literally, the gloves are off. There are no holds barred in the ways in which these guys tell each other exactly what they... It's like, how does it feel to betray your country? And, you know, how dare you? And it's real, real kind of in-your-face confrontation. It is like a gladiatorial sport. There are also, within that, MTV are involved in the documentary, which I have to say is... It's very, very insightful, but really rip-roaringly entertaining. It reminded me to some extent of there's a really good film called The Water Dance, directed by Neil Jimenez, which is that its three heroes are all in wheelchairs, but it's not about the wheelchairs. It's about them as men and them as very kind of, you know, macho guys with macho relationship problems. And that's what it's about. Well, this is about that. I mean, these guys are more jock-like than the most intense, full-on contact sport players, and they really take this seriously, and they really take their rivalry seriously. And the central character, this guy who kind of deserts the Americans to go off to coach the Canadians, he has, at the beginning of the film, these real relationship problems with his son, who's basically likes playing the violin and is a little bit kind of, you know, academic. And the father really does not understand the son until halfway through the film he has a heart attack. And then he gets better, and he has this kind of life-changing experience as a result of the heart. I mean, it's like the highs, the lows, the ups, there, all this nonsense that's in Elizabethtown about life-affirming drama. You want life-affirming drama, but which will kick your head in, Murderball is it.
Unfortunately, Mark, according to this from Tom, the press ads for Elizabethtown have a glowing quote from BBC Radio 5 Live.
Not me.
We explain this from Jerry in Lancashire said, Elizabethtown, a place you won't forget and a movie you'll fall in love with. James King on the movie ad.
No!
In the Times.
Is that what James said?
Apparently so.
So read it to me again.
A place you won't forget and a movie you'll fall in love with.
He can't have said that.
No.
Can you hear his voice saying those words?
No. Maybe in a slightly more wimpy way.
Well, OK, if he said it, everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Stew but... on this. I love listening to Mark's ranting. My wife's ranting isn't a patch on Mark's. Makes me realise how lucky I am. D in Blackpool, Mark morphed into David Walliams during that last rant. Andrew, who needs Victor Meldrew, Alf Garnett when you've got Mark and an entire career ahead of him? Duncan in Bristol, sorry, but is that a thumbs up or a thumbs down for Elizabethtown? Kevin Felixstowe, boy, what a rant. So, Mark, it's Saturday night, choice of two films, Pirates or Lizzietown. What's it to be?
It's put your head down the toilet and
no,
keep it there.
It's the choice. Make it.
Pirates of the Caribbean. Pirates of the Caribbean. Pirates of the Caribbean. That's how bad it is.
Like to hear you say that. It's all available back again if you want it and downloadable via the website. Movie of the week?
Well, the beat that my heart skipped, but go see Murderball because it is terrific.
Mark, thank you. Have a fantastic weekend. Back tomorrow, Monday at 1. Drive comes next on 5 Live.
Live news, live sport.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.